You may be seated there where you are, and if you are joining us for the first time here in the worship center or online, we have been in the middle of a series over the last couple of weeks entitled Rage, Dealing with an Angry World. And there is probably no more pertinent topic to discuss right now that I could share from this platform and over the last couple of weeks and over the next couple of weeks than to how in the world do we deal with the anger in our world. I don't know about you, but it seems like in our culture, if we wanted to, we have the ability to drink from a bottomless pit of anger and rage. How many of you understand that? It's like I can hardly even keep up with what I'm supposed to be mad about. Am I the only one that's what? Am I supposed to be mad about this or this? Or good grief, we were mad about that last week, and this week we're supposed to be mad about that. I can hardly keep up. And if you missed any one of the earlier messages, the first week we talked about, man, how to find joy in an angry world. And if you missed that, I encourage you to go online and find it and view that. Then last week we said, how in the world do we have good conversations when people are mad at us, when people are angry? And this week I want to talk to us and really examine the reality our culture lives in. Why are people angry? And I think we're going to uncover some things today as to why people are angry that will help us understand. And really, a lot of it has to do with worldview. What is their worldview? And you might think, well, I thought only Christians have a worldview. Let me tell you what, everybody has a worldview, whether you have it well-defined or not. Everybody comes to every situation, every circumstance, every conversation, every decision with a worldview in mind. Now, as we think about dealing with an angry world, I want you to know, as people of God, we have to be reminded that hot heads and cold hearts have never solved a problem. I'm going to say that again. Hot heads and cold hearts have never solved a problem once. That as followers of Christ, as people of God, we need to have cool heads and warm hearts for those who need the gospel. And let me tell you what, we see hot-headed people everywhere. On both sides of the aisle, on both sides of every argument, on both sides of every conversation. And if you want to find anger, you can find anger. If you want to find rage, you can find rage. But in the midst of that culture of anger, God's children, we need to be the people with big hearts and calm minds. Here's what I know, and I've learned this, and if you are a follower of Christ, you know this. Well, there are going to be people that hate us just because we're people of faith. How many of you understand that? We are going to be enemies to someone. And I want you to know, you and I, we can never keep someone from being our enemies and hating us. But I can control the way I respond to them and not act in an angry fashion towards them. That's all I can control. Regardless of where they operate and how they treat me, the one thing I can control is my reaction. That I can have a calm head and a warm heart towards those who attack me. And so as we think about why is our world so angry, if you go all the way back into the New Testament, James, the brother of Jesus, asked that question and he answers it for us. He tells us in those days, why are people around him so angry? Why are people in the church so angry? Why are people outside the church so angry? Why are people in life groups angry? Why are the people who are not in life groups angry? Why are people on the right side of the aisle angry? Why are people on the left side of the aisle? Why is everybody so angry? James, the brother of Jesus, if you don't know anything about James, James is a brother, doubted whether his brother was really God's son. He really rejected him for a while until a specific event happened, the resurrection of his brother. That he had heard all of the teachings his brother had delivered. He had heard about the miracles he had performed, and he rejected his brother's messiahship all the way through until a specific historical event took place, which was the brother that he saw and knew was nailed to a cross, that died on that cross, was buried in the tomb, showed up alive again, and James changed from a doubting faith to a following and believing faith. Then he kind of became the pastor there in that first church in Jerusalem. And in James chapter 4, verse 1, we're going to put it up on the screen. James began to look at the anger that was in his society and their culture at the time. And it's just like ours. And James begins to ask some questions. Why are we angry all the time? Well, then he answers the question. See, it's not just good enough for us as God's children to acknowledge that we live in an angry culture. We need to come with a response. So let's notice James's response. James chapter 4, verse 1. We'll put it up on the screen for you. Notice what James says. He says, what causes fights and quarrels among you? You know what he's saying? Why do we live in an age of outrage? Why do we live in a culture that is always angry? He says, here's the answer. Don't they come from your desires, that's personal desires, that battle within you? You know what James says right there? He says, our anger starts when we are self-centered. Take a marriage between a husband and wife. When does the difficulty happen? When the husband, instead of loving and serving his wife, becomes self-centered. Or when the wife, instead of loving and serving her husband, she becomes self-centered. That's exactly what James says. So if you look in the larger culture, not just a marriage, in the larger culture, when we become self-centered, where everything is about me, then guess what? I'm going to lack love, I'm going to become a hothead, and I'm not going to have a warm heart. And so James acknowledges that over 2,000 years ago. He says that's why there's so much rage. And so folks, as long as we live in a culture that preaches self and self-centeredness, we are going to live in an age of outrage. Then notice he doesn't stop there. He says, you desire, but you do not have, therefore you kill. Now, he's saying right there, that's kind of hyperbole. By the way, they use that in the Bible. He uses the illustration. He says, you desire, but you cannot have, so you kill. What is he saying? You kill somebody's character. You kill them with a comment. You say something about them. Sometimes you may actually kill them. Then he goes on. He says, you covet, but you cannot get what you want, so you quarrel and fight. So right here he said, hey, the outrage is there because we lack respect for each other. We kill them with comments. We kill them with words. We kill them with actions. We kill them. Not only that, we live self-centered lives. Then he says we live a jealous life. Man, if someone has a little more than me, I'm going to be jealous of them. If someone has earned a little more than I do, or if they got the promotion, or if they've got all the followers and I don't, if they get more likes than I do, then I'm going to be jealous and I'm going to covet what they have. Now, he doesn't stop there. He says, you do not have because you do not ask God. So look at what he's talked about. He said, we live in a self-centered society, which leads to anger and rage. We live in a society that lacks respect for other individuals that were created in the image of God. Therefore, we live in an anger of outrage. He goes, not only that, you live in a jealous society. We covet and want what someone has, but we can't have it. Therefore, we get angry and treat them inappropriately. Then he says, we live in a godless society. He says, man, you don't have because you don't ask God. Anybody ever notice that we live in a society that pushes God to the margins if they leave him in the margins at all? But James didn't stop there. He goes on. He says, and when you ask, you do not receive. Why? Because you ask with the wrong motives. You say, James, what's the wrong motive? He answers the question, that you would spend it on yourself. But he doesn't just say self, on what you get and your own pleasures. You want to know why we live in the age of outrage? It's the same reason James lived in the age of outrage. Because we have misplaced trust and priorities. If you think about why we live in a society, and like I said, it is a bottomless pit. We can drink from the bottomless mug of anger and rage. You drink some today, there'll be more tomorrow. You drink some tomorrow, there'll be more the next day. I mean, I really can't keep up with what I'm supposed to be mad about. It's kind of maddening. But as I thought about this, why is everybody so mad? I think there are a couple of reasons. I think you'll identify with these. You might want to write some of these down. Man, we have political differences. How many of you know we live in a political season? right? There are, if you haven't noticed, there are different political parties in our country. Have you noticed that? You've got all the way over here on this side, you've got the Republicans on one side, and then you've got the far-right Republicans, the middle-right Republicans, or the left-right Republicans. I'm not sure how you do that, but you have it. But then on the other side of the political spectrum, you have the Democrats. You have the far-left Democrats. You have the moderate Democrats. You have the middle Democrats. You have the other Democrats. Then right in the middle, you have those people we call independents. In other words, they don't have the guts to choose. And so we have these political differences. You've got people over here, you've got people over here, and you've got some people that are stuck right here. Not only that, you add to that another layer, not political differences, of economic theory. You have people that are very pro-capitalism, right? That, man, we live in a capitalistic society, that, man, the more you work hard and the more you achieve, you ought to be able to take it and put it in your pocket. And that's capitalism, that more of the people who own the most stuff ought to be individuals who work the hardest. Then you go on the far end of that spectrum, and you've got communism, right? That the government owns everything and they're going to give you everything. Everybody should get paid the same. Everybody should work about the same amount of time and everything's okay. Then you kind of have a mushy middle, right? That's called socialism. That here's what needs to happen is the government needs to control everything and run everything, but you ought to be able to get paid a little bit when you work a little more in this and that. And we've got that layer of economic theories, and boy, am I going to be more a capitalist or a communist or a socialist or somewhere in between. And if that were not enough, we have extremist groups. I don't know if you've noticed, we have extremist groups. There are a couple in our country. If you go to the far right, you have groups that just are basically white supremacist. Hopefully that's not a newsflash to you, but we have them in our country. That basically it goes back to the fascism of Nazi Germany, and they are here, and they are identified as the far right. But on the far left, you've got extremist groups over there, too. They're called Antifa, right? They are anti-fascist, and they're anti-this, and you're anti-that. And then on this side, you have your white nationalists, and on this side, you have your black separatists. I mean, you've got groups on both sides and everywhere in between. Then along with the political theory and the economic theories, and then you have these extremist groups, there's another one. We have moral issues that divide us. How many of you notice that from time to time, our country is divided over moral issues? Boy, there are a couple of moral issues. If you look at today's any survey of what moral issues create the most dissension in our country, and they're the same three. Let's define marriage. Is marriage between one man and one woman? Can it be same-sex marriage? Can it be cohabitation? Is one right and the other two are wrong? Or are they all right? Man, we argue and fight over that. Then you add to that moral issue the other layer of man, we're dealing with the issue of gender issues in our country, aren't we? There used to be just male and female, and now you've got male and female and trans, and now you've got male and female and trans and all other. And guess what? Wherever you stand on that side, that just adds another layer of complexity and something else for us to get mad about. But let's don't forget the biggest one of all, the issue of life, right? Our country is divided over the issue of life. The end of life and beginning of life. At what point is a life no longer worth living where a doctor can step in and help someone make a graceful exit? But let's just don't deal with the end of life. Let's go talk about the beginning of life. Is it the mother's right to choose, or should the government say no? Folks, why are people so angry? Because we have lost an understanding of what we should be trusting in, which is the God who created us. And let me tell you what. The outrage isn't just among unbelievers. It's oftentimes among believers as well. And so, child of God, as we journey through today, this idea of why are people so angry, I want to come to the table with the idea that the first thing we need to understand is why do people think the way they think? And that's an issue of worldview. But let's go back and let me give you a couple of thoughts. When you ask the question, all right, Pastor, if I want to live out my faith in a hostile world, if I want to have a calm head and a warm heart, what are my prospects? James, the brother of Jesus, has a couple of thoughts to say, and then let me give you two more verses before we really dive in. First of all, look at James chapter 3, verse 16. He says, "For where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you will find disorder and every form of evil." That's what we have right now in our country, right? For where you have envy and selfish ambition, there will be disorder. Some people selfishly want certain political parties to win, or they want certain economic theories to show up. They want one moral issue to be legal and another moral issue to be right, and whoever has the power makes the rules. Man, every time we see that, not just today, but throughout history, disorder shows up. Then you say, all right, well, Pastor, if I'm going to really try to apply my Christian faith and my Christian walk, what's going to be my outcome? Look at Proverbs 10, verse 28. Here's Solomon, the wisest man who ever lived. He said, "The prospect of the righteous is joy, but the hopes of the wicked will ultimately come to nothing." So I want us to say, as we step back today and we unpack the reasons why people are angry and how it relates to their worldviews, I want us to know that if we live out our faith in a joyful, loving, and caring way, if we live out our faith with calm heads and warm hearts, we're going to have a positive impact on others. That's first of all. But secondly, my prospects of joy greatly increase. But if conversely, I become just as hot-headed as those who are without God, if I get just as cold-hearted as those who are without God, there will be no more joy in your life than those who are without God. So let's begin to ask ourselves the questions. What is a worldview? And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about a worldview. It's really the way you see things. Worldviews are important. We need to understand. First of all, worldviews, everyone's got one. All right? Everybody's got a worldview. They are absolutely universal. The second thing you and I need to understand about worldviews is they really are the lenses through which we look at the world. They are the lenses through which we look at the world. That's why you can have people see the same historical event and have two different responses. You say, Pastor, when does that happen? Hey, let's all get on a bus. Let's go up to the Supreme Court sometime, right? When the Supreme Court is debating a hot topic. And guess what? Anytime you do this, you've seen the pictures, there will be people who are for and against outside the Supreme Court, large crowds. And as soon as the judgment of the Supreme Court comes down, one event, half of the people celebrate and half the people go away angry and mad. See, that's a worldview issue. How do we see the world? Those are the lenses through which we see the world. Beyond that, not only does everybody have a worldview and they're the lenses through which we see the world, they affect every decision that we make. See, and that's really where, as a Christian, we need to understand that we need to step back and understand, what is my worldview? Is it thoroughly Christian? And we're going to talk about what that is today. But then also, when I look at the world, do I look at the world through the lenses of my faith and a biblical lens? Then finally, are my decisions consistent with the faith I proclaim? Now, as we think about this idea of worldviews, and there's the Christian worldview and an unchristian worldview, I thought, why do people reject the faith? Why do people reject Christianity? Let me give you a couple of thoughts. I think there are times that some people have intellectual objections to Christianity, right? They're like, man, I don't see God. I don't know that God is here. Man, I just need some facts. I'll submit to you, if you're really willing to be honest with the science, about why there's something and not nothing, and while that something has order and design, you have to say there's some sort of creative being that is out there that put it all together. Boy, if you just look at the human genome and all the patterns that are there, they are intricately woven together and created. And so we need to understand that there are times that people, they have intellectual objections. They've always heard there's no proof there's God, there's no proof there's not God. And those are really kind of the easiest ones to answer. The intellectual objections. I think there are other times that people have, you know, kind of a relational problem with Christianity. That anybody ever had someone say, you know what, I don't go to church because when I was growing up, a Christian was mean to me, or a pastor hurt me. How many of you know what I'm talking about? You know what, and the reality of it is, that's true. There are times that Christians have done bad things to non-Christians. And we've got to acknowledge that. And if someone comes up to you and says, man, when I grew up in this church, man, the youth group did this to me, or some Christian did that to me, or I grew up and my mom and dad, we went to church every Sunday and we all prettied up, but man, when we got in the car after church, it was like hell blown over. And therefore, I'm never going to go because I don't want that to be my faith. There are times that people have relational issues. What is your job? Just be what Christ wanted you to be. I think there are times that people reject the faith because they don't necessarily get it. It's not a relational wound. It's an emotional wound. You ever had someone look at you after a tragic event and say, why would God allow that to happen? Someone look at you and say, you know, why would God allow my sister to die of cancer? I can tell you that's a hard... As a pastor, I've stood in rooms with loving families, with a godly person or a young person and a child when they've taken their last breath, and have a dad or a mom look at me and say, why would God let this happen? Let me tell you what, folks, that is a real issue and a legitimate question. But I also want you to know, as someone who's been in that room, we have answers. And the answers are found in loving God. And how someday, some way, somehow, in the future, He's going to fix it all. And that's really where we need to be. So sometimes people reject it because they have intellectual reasons for rejecting Christianity. Those are the easy ones. Sometimes it's a relational issue. Some Christian has hurt them in the past. Sometimes it's an emotional issue. Man, they've been hurt by some event that's taken place in life. Here's the biggest one, and you might want to just write this down. I think it's volitional. I think we see a lot of that in modern culture today, that people reject God because they want to be God. Doesn't matter how many intellectual evidences you give them, how many scientific evidences you give them, how much you live out your faith in front of them. They just don't want there to be a God. Why? Because they don't want the guilt that comes along with knowing they answer to a holy and righteous God. In fact, they want to choose pleasure over God. I think that's one of the reasons why when kids go off to college, we always talk about it, the stats of how many kids grow up in church and then they go off to college and all of a sudden lose their faith in God. Well, part of the reason I truly believe is simply this, is because let me tell you what, if there's not a God, you can have a lot more fun. How many of you know what I'm talking about? If you haven't had fun doing sin, you tried the wrong sin. Let me just tell you, I've tried some sins that I considered that was good. Now, you're saying, did the pastor just say that? Yeah, I did. Because it's a reality, right? Man, if I go off to college, I've grown up in youth camp, I've grown up in church, gone to youth camp, gone to the youth ministry, and all of a sudden I'm at college and my parents aren't waking me up, putting me in a car, dressing me up, driving me to church. Therefore, I can stay out a little later on Saturday night, my parents won't know. and they text you and say, what are you doing tonight? And it's 11:30 on Saturday night, and you text them and say, I'm in the library studying. You're lying through your teeth. And you finally roll in about 2:30 in the morning. Why in the world would you want to wake up and go hear a pastor preach about sin? That's not fun. So they want pleasure. And that is true, right? We all want that. Man, I think there are some people, they reject the idea of God because they want to be God. Their God is self. And their answer is, there is no God. It's not well thought out. It's not real. So what does a good worldview look like? What does a biblical worldview look like? What does every worldview look like? It's got to answer four questions. And here these are questions. If you don't know what your worldview is, you've got to ultimately answer these four questions for you to see life right. Question number one is a question of beginnings. All right? Where did it all come from? Where did we come from? Why is there something instead of nothing? It is the issue of beginnings. It's the issue of origins. Look at Genesis chapter 1, verse 27. Here's what we say as children of God, Genesis 1, 27. So God created mankind. Now, if you go all the way back to Genesis 1, verse 1, it says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. What do we know as God's children? Our worldview, when it comes to the origins of the universe, the beginnings of the universe, is that God created something out of nothing. That's our worldview. Then if you go on down and read verse 27, so God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. So what do we believe? All life from beginning to end is an image bearer of God who created them. Why? Because God created each and every one of us in his image. Then he goes on, he created them male and female. He created them. Notice some worldview conflicts right here. Created them male and female. Then if you go on down, God blessed them and then said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the sky and every other living creature that moves on the ground. Now, just from this passage here, we see that whatever the origin of the universe was powerful, intellectual, as well as personal. You mean powerful? Powerful enough to create something out of nothing. Intellectual enough to finely tune our universe. Relational enough to create male and female and bless them and encourage them to be together. Now, that's the Christian worldview. However, there are others who do not carry the Christian worldview. On one side, you have a theist worldview. Our theist worldview, when it comes to beginnings, is that God created everything. God is powerful, intellectual, and relational. God created everything. However, on the other end of that spectrum, you have those who refer to themselves as atheists. They would say there is no God, therefore this all happened by chance. Now, I want you to know there was always this dichotomy between theists and atheists, but over the last couple of decades, there has developed not just a theist and atheist category, but there has developed a third category called anti-theist category. These are people that they're just not comfortable being atheist. They want to be against God altogether, regardless of what the facts mean. Now, I'll give you two names, and you can go read about the new atheist. One is Christopher Hitchens. The other one's Richard Dawkins. These are scientists who have begun to sell amazing books about the fact that God doesn't exist. And as you look at universities, they've had amazing impact on other professors and others within the university setting. One of the reasons I said earlier that people, that a lot of kids that leave church, they go off to college, they lack belief in God is because they like their own sin, and it sin's more fun without a God. But I think another reason is the culture they find in universities. According to the most recent study I could find, do you know that among all universities from West Coast to East Coast, from South to North, in all universities, including Christian and non-Christian universities, secular universities, that professors in any college or university are five times more likely to identify as atheist than the general public? Five times. Went back to the last time we elected a president. And there was a survey done of university professors and university scholars, those that were in the college, and they asked them, when it comes to political leaning, if you take the center line, do you as a professor of university lean right or lean left? Now, by the way, don't get mad at me. I'm just sharing you the data. They answered the survey. 29-1, professors lean left over right. That's a culture issue, right? Our kids, it's not just in the science class, it's in math class, it's in economics, it's in everywhere, in every place, it's in English. They are showing up in a culture where self-identified 29-1. I want you to know this is not new data. A couple of years I shared it, and let me tell you, I shared it just like I just shared it, 29-1. There was a professor at a local college that was in the audience, sent me an email the next day. I no longer feel safe and accepted at Cottonwood Creek. I want you to know that is not what I am saying. As a matter of fact, if you are a professor and you're an atheist, whether you're watching online, if you lean left, if you lean right, it doesn't matter. You are welcome at Cottonwood Creek, but I'm telling you the truth. But then what will happen is these new anti-theists will take that data and say, well, isn't it interesting that professors in a university are five times more likely than the general public to say that they are atheist, therefore it's true. Hang on. Let's take that the other way. If I went down to the local Chick-fil-A and surveyed all their employees, I said, hey, are you a Christian or not? Are you a theist or not? My guess is it would be more than 5-1 that there is a God, right? And if I said, hey, as employees, the people of Chick-fil-A, do you lean right or do you lean left? My guess is they would lean right more than they lean left. Well, what does that say? It's a culture thing. Chick-fil-A has identified themselves as distinctively Christian. Therefore, they have a tendency to attract people that are distinctively Christians. Let me tell you what, universities for a long time have been trying to establish themselves as distinctly secular. Therefore, they attract those who are willing to identify with those organizations that are distinctly secular. That doesn't mean it's true. Go to Richard Dawkins. You look this up, Google it. Richard Dawkins sent a warning shot to the scientific community that said, listen, if you ever want to have a conversation with me, if you ever want to have a dialogue with me, he said, you better see what I see. His words, exact words. He says, when you study biology, it is going to scream that there is a creator, but there isn't one. Does that sound intellectually honest? Does that sound intellectually honest? He says, when you study biology, when you look at the human genome, when you look at the idea that there is life and there's not non-life, and life doesn't create out of nothingness. He says, when you look at all that, it's going to scream there is a creator, but listen, if you want to be accepted in my club, there's not one. Man, that's a problem. See, because at the end of the day, all knowledge comes from what? A study of cause and effect. And we have to understand that if we're going to have real knowledge, if we're going to be honest about what is really here, we're going to have to accept wherever the evidence leads us. And the truth is, a lot of evidence leads us to the belief there is a God. You ever had a conversation with someone who struggles with the idea that they believe that God exists? And you at least have heard this illustration. Someone say, well, hey, what would it take for you to believe God exists? You ever heard someone say something similar to this? Well, if God would just come down and write in the sky, "Hi, John Mark, this is God." Anybody ever heard that kind of idea, that thought, if God would just show up? Well, guess what? They're actually defeating their own argument. Because clouds, inanimate objects, things that don't have minds, don't speak to you. Couldn't I just respond to them, say, you know what, if you just give it enough time, those clouds will say, "Hi, I'm God." They would go, "No, they won't. There's no intellect behind them." See, and that's what we see in creation all the time. God is saying something. So for us as God's children, I believe the data speaks to a personal, powerful, intellectual God. That's why we're here. That's the first question you and I have to answer if we're going to have a solid worldview. Others choose to reject the idea of God, but they have no data on their side. Because you never see anywhere where nothing turns into something. Where life comes from non-life. It doesn't happen. The second question that we all have to answer if we're going to have a good biblical worldview is the idea, not just beginning, but the second question is meaning. Man, why are things the way they are? The meaning in life. And I will just tell you, as you think this through, it's really a question of evil. And I will tell you, you heard me share a few minutes ago about going in those hospitals, the question of evil, why is there evil in this world? Why are things the way they are? That is a tough question for all of us to answer. I want you to know, as your pastor, that is a tough question to answer. But at least in our worldview, we have an explanation for it. What's that explanation called? That explanation is called sin. God created everything in His image, and it was good. But God also loved us enough that He created us as free beings. And in creating us as free beings, what does God do? He then gave us the right to choose to honor Him or break His laws, to obey His laws or break His laws. What happened? The first couple, Adam and Eve, but I want to remind you, it was Eve first. They sinned. And the world and creation and relationships and you and me have all been bearers of consequences because of it. Look at Genesis chapter 3. We'll put it up on the screen. Notice what it says. Genesis chapter 3, here we are. He says this, "He answered and he said to them," he says, "I heard you in the garden and I was afraid." This is God. He showed up. The Adam and Eve have sinned. Now Adam is afraid. He said, "Because I was naked, so I hid." This is Adam, his response to God. And he said, "Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree that I commanded you not to eat from?" And the man said, "That woman you put here with me, she gave me some of the fruit from the tree, and I ate it." Let me just tell you what, as you step back, you think about all this. I mean, see, ladies, you see this from one perspective, and men, we see it from another perspective. Let me tell you how I see this. This is tragic because now we all have to buy clothes. Think of how much of our budgets we would have left over. Actually, let's don't think about that. Let's go on. It says, "The man said, that woman you appeared here." What are we doing? Shifting the blame. "She gave me some of the fruit of the tree to eat, and I ate it. Then the Lord said to the woman, what is this that you have done? And that woman said, that serpent that you put here gave it to me, and I ate it." Now, let me just stop you right here. That is our explanation for why evil exists. You and I need to understand, why does evil exist? Because man rebelled against God's laws. God set up this world with laws and with order that would bring good and prosperity and love and great relationships. But He also wanted to give us the ability to choose to be for Him or against Him. And we chose against Him. And ultimately, at the end of the day, that is the issue of good and evil. Why is there evil? Because we've rebelled against a holy and righteous God. If you think about the whole idea of the origins of the universe. If you take our side as Christians and as our believers, and you were to make a category, you ever done this, helped with your kids when they have a tough decision to make? You say, hey, draw a line, draw a chart, right? Yes, make the decision. No, make the decision. Have you ever done that with your kids? Say, hey, produce all the positives, all the negatives. All right, let's go on the side. If there is a God, let me tell you what. Here's all the list of things that are on the side that there is a God. There was a beginning. We know the universe has a beginning. We know that at some point something came out of nothing. We know there is life. We've never seen life come from non-life. There is a fine-tuning in our universe that allows us to live. There are laws of logic, laws of math, laws of nature that are totally consistent. You say, how did that happen? Well, it happened by chaos. You're going, no, I don't think it did. What would happen? If some days when we left church, we walked outside the church and all of a sudden gravitation pulled us up and not down. And in other days we leave and it pulls us down and not up. What if you and I woke up one day and all of a sudden 1 + 1 wasn't 2, a laws of math? What if some days it was 27 and the other day it was 13? That'd be a crazy world, right? But we live in this world that is fine-tuned. Then you add to that the historical figure named Jesus, who eyewitnesses said they saw him die on the cross, saw him buried in the tomb, saw him rise again the third day. There's a lot of evidence that says there is a God. I will submit to you the only evidence that a non-theist has against the existence of God is this one argument: evil. Why does evil exist? Here's my ultimate answer. God created everything good, but he loved us enough, he wanted to give us to have an opportunity to make a choice either for him or against him. All the way back to the garden, we sinned. And that's the corrosion on good. I'll submit to you, that's their only argument. But I would say, the fact that there is evil confirms the fact that there is good, right? Hey, when we walk out and you go to your car, look down on the ground, what are you going to see? It's going to be something called a shadow, right? What does a shadow do? It confirms the existence of a sun. What does evil do? It confirms the existence of good. You ever driven through the countryside knowing I was going to preach this week? When we took my son up to Arkansas, from time to time you'll go through some of those places in Arkansas and Oklahoma, and you ever looked out in a field and seen a car that had been sitting in the field for a long, long time, and you've looked over and you recognize that car? You know, don't we all, men, every guy in this room, you have this great desire that somewhere, someday, you're going to go find in the middle of a field, you're just going to see it, it's going to be a $1 million car. All you have to do is go get it. You're going to talk to the people who own the car, say, hey, I noticed this car's been sitting out there probably for 20 years. Here's $100. I'll just haul it off for you. Then you fix it up and you sell it for $1 million. Am I the only guy that ever thinks about that? Because I think about that. That would be so cool. I found it in a field, and I paid $100 for it. And what did I do? I took this rust bucket, I took all the rust off of it, and I made it a better car, right? But see, listen. You take rust off the car, you make it a better car. You take the car away, you don't have rust. It's like the sun in the shadow. Rust presumes the existence of a car, and having a car allows for the possibility of having rust. So evil presumes that there is a good, but good allows the possibility for bad. What about in my line of work? How many of you know I speak for a living? My greatest hazard as a pastor, besides mean deacons, is a paper cut, right? How many of you have ever had a paper cut? Anybody ever get a bad paper cut? It just annoys you and you can't, you know, you can take the paper cut out of the finger, but you take the finger away, you got nothing. That's the way it is with good and evil. So when someone says to you, let me tell you why I don't believe there's a God. because evil exists, you need to have the ready answer. Let me tell you why evil exists. Because God loved us so much, He created us in such a way that He would allow us to choose to reject Him or accept Him. So question number one, every worldview has to answer, is where did we all come from? Question number two is, what is the meaning? Why is everything the way it is? The third question we all have to answer is one of morality. What is right and what is wrong? Isn't that it? I mean, at the end of the day, in our culture right now, a lot of things we argue about is over a definition of what is right, what is wrong. What is acceptable, what isn't acceptable. I'll just submit to you right now, if there is no God, there is no wrong. Listen to what I just said. If there is no God, there is no wrong. Because if there is no God, you just go all the way back to the Darwinian approach, that it is survival of the fittest, good luck to all. But we don't like that idea, do we? Man, we step back and we think of the horrors that Hitler committed back in Nazi Germany when he took the Jews and he put them in the gas chamber. We as a culture, a community, a country, a world, identify that as sinful and wrong behavior. Why? Because there's a God who said all life is precious. Take God away. Survival of the fittest. I'll submit to you, if you take God away, don't say Hitler was wrong. That's just a reality. It's all about voting and it's all about what we believe. Here's what we need to understand, that our truth comes from the fact there is a God. And He created all of us in His image. And we need to see that and know that. Boy, if you look in this world, man, there are a couple of different types of evil, right? Sometimes there's personal evil. Someone does something to someone else. That's what Hitler did to the Jews. And sometimes there's natural evil. They're just natural disasters. Difficult things happen. Hard things happen. Man, those are hard to explain, but the truth is we step back and identify something as good and something as bad. Why? Because the fact there is a God. So, child of God, we need to know what we believe and why we believe it. We need to know what our arguments for. We also need to know what responses we have to their arguments. The creation screams of a creator, though some reject it. That's our beginning. The reason why there is evil, because God loved humanity so much that He created us with free will and we choose to disobey it. That's why evil exists. But the very fact that evil exists guarantees us there's a good, just like a shadow says there's a sunshine. You only have a shadow because there's a sun. You take away the sun, you don't have anything. Then for us, why do we know and how do we define what is right and what is wrong? Because we've got a God who created this law and order society that we live in. That there are certain things that are right and certain things that are wrong. And that's the way we delineate everything. And then someone says, well, what about those who are not in church and did not grow up in church? They don't know the law. Paul dealt with that in Romans chapter 2. Paul said, those who do not have the law, sometimes they do instinctively that which is in the law. Why? Because they have a conscience bearing witness either for them when they do something good or against them when they do something bad. See, that's the reality. God not only gave us law that was written in our hearts, but a reality of His love for us through His Son, Jesus Christ. And the fourth question that every worldview has to answer, not just beginning, not just meaning, why is evil here, not just morality, what is right and what is wrong, is where are we headed? It's an issue of the future. It's an issue of destiny. See, a biblical worldview says God created it all. The meaning and the reason evil is here because sin exists. There is such a thing as a right and wrong. And at the end of the day, we're all, for those who trusted in Jesus Christ, we're heading to a place that we long and desire to be in. Isn't that what we want? See, the Bible says that the reason why God hadn't shut it all down yet is because He's long-suffering, merciful, and a gracious God. And that He desires everybody that would come to repentance. See, God does, in fact, permit some evil to happen, some bad things to happen. And there's no doubt there are people in this room that some bad things have happened to you. But I want you to know it's not because God doesn't love you. God does allow evil to linger because God loves humanity. There is going to come a day in Revelation 21 when there's no more death, no more sinning, no more dying, no more pain. But when that day shows up, there'll be no opportunity for salvation for anyone. It'll be over. So here's the question you have. Anybody here have an aunt or uncle you want them to come to faith? Do you want God to remove evil? The moment God removes evil, there's no more opportunity for their salvation. Anybody here had an email yesterday, pray for me as I try to find out if my father, who is aging, is a Christian before he dies. You want God to remove evil? Take away the opportunity for salvation as well. Until then, we have to live in a difficult world. So, child of God, when we leave here today, we leave here with calm heads and warm hearts. Calm head because I know where we came from. I know why evil exists. I know what's right and wrong. I know where we're headed. The truth is, those who reject God don't have answers for the origins of the universe. You say, Pastor, what about all the science? Let me tell you what the science says. Nothing begets nothing. Non-life begets non-life. And as we journey out of here today, the greatest hope we have is the fact that over 2,000 years ago, Jesus rose from the grave. Let's bow our heads. Father, thank you so much for this day. And as we journey out of here as your children, we journey out of here with calm heads and warm hearts for a world that is broken and hurting. God, I pray if there's someone in this room that their faith has begun to fail just a little bit, I pray this has been a challenge for them, an encouragement for them, that we have reasons to believe, the only reasons that really stand up to the questions. God, for those who are viewing online who might be struggling along the way, I pray that they would know from this message, this sermon, that there is hope for them, there's hope for their future. God, if someone here has never trusted you as Savior and Lord or online, I pray that this would be the day. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen and amen.